flaccid toast.
Flaccid is another word for the list of words we shouldn't ever say.
Flaccid.
I'll add it to the list.
Thank you.
We have a literal list, listeners, if this makes it to the show somehow.
If this ends up in the show, yes, listeners, we have a list of bad words. Have you put clown eggs on it?
I think, no, maybe not. Hold on. Here it is. Bad words. My bad words list. So clown eggs. And what did we just say? Flaccid.
Flaccid.
All right. So we've got flesh, ripe, slippery, leatherous, froth, mumble sucker, hinge, clown eggs, and flaccid.
Words to
the
not
forbidden
be
words. The forbidden words. There we go.
One day I will remember all of them and try and sneak all of them into a single episode summary.
You think I won't notice if you say mumble sucker.
Right, mumble sucker's a bit hard, but I feel like I can separately get mumble and sucker into a sentence.
Yeah. So, how have you been? How have you been?
I enjoyed a week off. Not that I did anything different than what I've been doing for the last 5 months. I studied and sewed. Ooh, on bank holiday Monday, I decided to see if I could make a dress from scratch in a single day.
And could you?
I could. And I'm calling all of the ways in which it is asymmetric a design feature, yeah, rather than I am bad at sewing straps on.
It's a feature, not a bug.
Mm-hmm.
This is something you're learning concurrently with the developing stuff. So
yeah, between studying web development and studying sewing, that is the main thing I've learned. Feature, not bug. I also had a brilliant moment of genius yesterday.
So
in the coding course I'm doing, we're currently building a massive app, front and back end, called Yelp Camp, where people can list campsites and review them. And
okay,
but it involves building the server side of everything as well. And sure. So the day before yesterday, I was studying how to handle errors in servers, which meant intentionally generating errors so I could then look at all the ways in which they get handled. It's very dull. yesterday morning, some tickets for a festival I was hoping to go to in August went on sale. But obviously their servers went down because everyone was trying to get tickets. So I clicked on the link and it came up with this error. And it was the same error I had been trying to generate. So that I could learn how to handle it the day before. And it wasn't very well handled. They didn't have like a nice template for it to come up or anything.
Tut.
But I got really confused and thought I'd accidentally reopened my server and clicked on that page rather than the ticket link before I realised what was happening.
Ah, yes. Yeah, yeah.
I did not eventually succeed in getting tickets for this festival, sadly.
No. I have to say, one of my favourite things about learning basic web development stuff was learning how to click into like Chrome development tools and get rid of annoying elements on web pages.
Yeah, that bit is quite
yeah
fun.
Fuck you, pop-up.
Yes, disabling pop-ups via the dev tools is quite fun. And also since I started learning, like, especially things like CSS frameworks, being able to look at websites and go, this is Bootstrap.
Yes, yeah. Or eventually you'll get to this is Squarespace.
Mm-hmm.
Not a sponsor.
We are not sponsored by Squarespace.
I've listened to so many Squarespace ads this week. I'm going to go berserk. I've just had a glut of podcasts all Squarespace. Squarespace and what's the other one? HelloFresh and...
BetterHealth. That one keeps coming up a lot.
No, not that one. It's some CBD bollocks.
Oh, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Don't know me. It's bollocks.
Not many of the podcasts I listen to have adverts. I think because I don't listen to many American ones, and I find the bigger American ones tend to be the ones that then have the ad revenue and stuff. I have nothing against podcasts having adverts.
No, the more kind of indie British ones and indie American ones I listen to do tend to have ads, but for other podcasts within their little network, which
I don't mind so much.
Yeah, like Pushkin and Rusty Quill, whatever.
That I don't mind so much. Some of the bigger ones I listen to, like The Storm, The Lost One, they have adverts, but they are always in the same place in the episode, so they're very easy to skip.
Yes, yeah.
Like, I love it when podcasts put distinctive music on the back of their adverts, so they're easy to fast forward through.
Yes, yeah, when it's just the podcast host, like, reading out their things in their normal voice, it is a bit tricky. Naked Wines, there it is, I thought of it. Naked Wines is the other one I've had a lot of, yeah, which I don't feel bad about. Like, sometimes I'll just try and leave the add-ons. I'm like, oh, in a tiny, tiny way, I'm helping support by not skipping. Yeah. But if it's like wine or CBD or something, I'm like, yeah, I have a card to use here.
Yeah. Jay Rayner's podcast, Out to Lunch, I'd never skip the adverts on it purely because they tend to actually be for things I will actually use because it tends to be food related.
Sure.
Like, I found my favourite online butcher through a discount code on one of his adverts.
Well, there you go.
Who do very, not an advert, but Farmerson do supply very lovely meat and have the my favourite small marketing tool, which is on the email list. They will send out an email saying, would you like to opt out of things like Mother's Day emails and Valentine's Day emails?
Yes, that is good. I will probably not be using an online butcher, but...
Well, yes, you are a vegetarian.
Is it raining again now?
It's not, because if it does start raining heavily, the sound on my end is going to be shite.
Oh, no, yeah, you've got all the windows and the balconies in there, yeah.
Yeah, I've just left my letterbox taped up constantly. There's a big enough gap that the postman appears to just be able to get letters through. I caught the postman and apologised the other day for the fact it's taped closed and explained why, and it's just like, yeah, it's fine.
Is it worth just getting some foam?
It doesn't stop it. I would just get thuds rather than bangs. And the taping is the only way. The wind, something about where the entrance to my flat is, the wind catches it and will slam it against itself constantly.
Yeah, because it's some like weird little...
There's a microclimate outside my front
that's
door.
That's what I'm trying to say. Thank you. Well done.
And I bet you thought I was just pleased to see you.
Hey. Well, on that note, Joanna.
Should we make a podcast? Clearly,
yes, let's make a podcast. Clearly not got anything interesting to say today.
Have you know my microclimate is fascinating.
Yes, darling, but not before the watershed.
Hello and welcome to The Truth Shall Make You Fret, a podcast in which we are usually reading and recapping every book from Terry Pratchett's Discworld series, one at a time, in chronological order. I'm Joanna Hagen.
And I'm Francine Carroll.
And this is part two of our proto-Pratchett season.
Yes.
We are discussing Strata, Terry Pratchett's second novel, and this is part one of our discussion.
Don't alarm people. I managed to post part two of the last one as part three on the Reddit and managed to alarm somebody slightly, but I was just sleepy.
We're good at numbers here at The Truth Shall Make You Fret.
Truth Shall Make You Fret, brackets, good at numbers. If you have to specify, you know it's true.
Anyway, yes, this is part one of our discussion of Strata, Terry Pratchett's second novel.
Yes.
And another sci-fi parody-ish.
Third novel.
Oh, yeah, of course, Carpet People. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Which we will be discussing in November.
Yes, because we like to do things out of order.
And because that's when it's 50th anniversary.
I'm out of order. You're out of order.
Yes, this whole podcast is out of order. Note on spoilers before we get started. We're a spoiler-light podcast. Obviously, heavy spoilers for Strata, the book we're on. But we will avoid spoiling major future events in the Discworld series. And we're saving any and all discussion of the final Discworld novel, The Shepherd's Crown, until we get there. So you, dear listener, can come on the journey with us.
In a terrifying spaceship with a cryogenically frozen dude in it.
And an elsewhere engine. So have we got anything to follow up on? I don't think we've got anything to follow up on.
No, only that our first Patreon episode came out, so
yes,
patrons will be able to find that now if they haven't already.
If you haven't signed up to our Patreon yet, we've released our first bonus Down the Rabbit Hole episode, in which I had a much more qualified than me friend come on to discuss landscape architecture.
It's not me.
Do you not have a degree in landscape architecture? What the hell?
I am equally unqualified in everything as you are.
Look, being unqualified has never stopped me before, and it's not going to stop me now. And remember, if you sign up to the Patreon anytime, you'll have access to all previous bonus nonsense.
Previous bonus nonsense. My new band name.
Excellent.
Cool. Yeah, apart from that, no, I don't have any follow-up I can think of. Did I even write anything down? I don't think so.
I wrote many things down, but it doesn't mean I'm going to keep track of them.
We're good. Yeah.
I found a note in my ideas notebook the other day that just said pirate dolphins in capital letters.
Good.
it turns out it's to do with the Tumblr post I read when I was half asleep. Someone else then sent me the Tumblr post again the next day, and I got the context from that.
Every now and then I go through some of my notebooks that I really need to throw out just to see if there's anything like valuable in there, good bit of writing or like a bank card number or something.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately I'm fairly indiscriminate with most of my notebooks. And occasionally, yeah, I'll just find like lists of completely unrelated things as far as I can tell. I once found a list that split into two. And one side had like a bunch of random kitchen equipment listed and the other side was empty. I was like, wonder what I got into doing there. Hope it's not dangerous, whatever I left undone.
Well, so far you've not died, so I think we're doing well. So Strata, Francine,
oh, yeah,
would you
right.
like to introduce us to the book?
I suppose, if we must stop talking about random crap in notebooks. Yeah. So Strata is this book, holding up for the camera, and listeners, please look at your covers, because I'm told all of them are bad. We've got Josh Kirby's masterpiece of are men drawing women.
just tits.
I think slightly before he started using reference pics. Because as far as I can tell, these tits are in several dimensions at once.
Transdimensional tits, my future band name.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a cover. I've got to say, this style for me works a lot better on fantasy than it does on sci-fi.
I think this is just parody-ish on the side of sci-fi for the cover to work, but I can't get past the bosoms.
Yeah. Anyway, so this is Strata, which I, despite the cover, have quite enjoyed the book. They should make a saying about that. It is part of our Proto Pratchett season. As you said, the third of Terry Pratchett's novels and the last one before Discworld started. It was originally published in 1981. It was inspired by, or is a parody of, Larry Niven's...
Niven?
Yeah. Ringworld. In many, many ways. I mean, it's 200-year-old protagonist, mysterious artificial world mission, crash landing, etc., etc. And Pratchett himself said, I intended Strata to be as much a piss take slash homage slash satire on Ringworld as, say, Bill the Galactic Hero was of Starship Troopers. All Niven's heroes are competent and all this technology works for millions of years. But he's a nice guy and says he enjoyed the book. In fact, I saw it mentioned somewhere that he and Pratchett were considering a collaboration at one point, but decided their writing styles or working styles were just too incredibly difficult
to merge.
And I had a look through some of the reviews and they are almost all glowing. And my favorite, which is to say most abhorrent line, is from Kirkus, where they said, "It's a gleefully madcap flat earth jaunt."
Gleefully madcap.
Gleefully madcap jaunt, Joanna. You thought it couldn't get better than Journey.
I feel like we need to put madcap in the same category as vivacious, as words we don't use. Oh, zany, wacky.
Yeah, no, there's a different list for these words. Yeah. It's not because they make us physically recoil. It's because they make us like mentally shrivel.
Yeah.
Wacky, zany.
Madcap.
I don't mind vivacious. I never see vivacious used to describe literature.
No, I think I'm mixing up the wacky and zany line about redheads in sitcoms from the opening of one of the other books. Anathema in Good Omens.
Ah, yes.
I didn't mean vivacious. I did mean wacky, zany and madcap.
It's very, very easy to mistake.
They all reek of organised fun.
Don't they?
And that is one of my least favourite kinds of fun.
I try to enjoy organised fun, and on occasion I do.
Organised fun always involves someone, usually a man, going, "Right, guys!" And that makes me want to tear out my own eyeballs and throw them at him.
Yes.
As I learn how to say eyeballs.
Anyway, do you want to summarise part one? Oh, where do we go up to? Because you've got two editions.
I bought two editions by accident. The first one I bought, which doesn't match yours, is a much older copy. So the early Corgi paperback. It went up to, I believe, page 98. And in the newer paperback, it's page 139. The final line of this section on the disc east couldn't be a direction. It had to be a point of the circumference. There were four directions on the disc: circle right, circle left, in, out. They headed in.
otherwise known as Turnwise, Widdershins, Hubwoods, and Rimwoods.
Yes.
Yay!
So they're going Hubwoods. So in this section, on a beautiful brochured day, our hero Kin Arad watches a beach being built before berating a couple of young builders for a brilliant prank. A mysterious man appears in Kin's office with wild tales of advanced tech. He demonstrates an invisibility cloak and hints at matter transmission. Kin and Jago Jalo, her office in Chiruda, head for lunch. He claims to be a Terminus probe pilot sent out into the universe to explore its reaches over 1,000 years ago. He tells Kin of a mysterious flat world and bribes her with clever counterfeit days to join him on an exploratory mission before vanishing into the ether. A few weeks later, Kin greets the first settlers of the newly completed planet and finds her ex-husband set on freezing himself to watch over this new world, finding a way to live longer into the future than the current immortal currency of gene therapy and days allows. He warns Kin of an incoming economic crash after the discovery of J-Lo's clever forgeries. Leaving the new Earth, Kin finds J-Lo has redirected her ship to Kung, a damp and desolate world. On Kung, Kin heads to the pub and meets Marco, a human in Kung form, and a talented pilot hired by J-Lo with a bag producing infinite currency. A large raven interrupts and joins the newly formed gang as they find themselves taken to a suspiciously epic spacefaring vessel. On the ship, Marco and Kin meet Silver, a betusked Shandi linguist slash historian slash herder, ready to join the...
Betusked is an excellent word, sorry to interrupt.
No, that's fine. Ready to join the excursion to the Flat Earth. J-Lo enters, pistol in hand, and threatens the gang. The raven sweeps to their defense, and J-Lo suffers a massive coronary. Luckily, death is not the end as he's placed into cryogenic stasis, and the raven hides. After a brief film of what appear to be dragons, our ragtag bunch of misfits agree to head across the universe and investigate the Flat Earth. The mystery raven lurks in an airlock as Kin disposes of the infinite purse. Shandi reads Kin's theory of constant creation before the gang arrive at the flat planet. They experience the strange spherical orbit in a dome full of fake planets, maneuver their way into the planetary dome, crash into a fake faux planet, and lose half their ship. We see a more ordinary ship go sailing over the edge of the world, and the gang make their landing with a dumb waiter in tow to provide dinners. The raven follows at a distance. As dawn comes, they agree to attempt to find the masters of the disc, an obviously man-made planet. A human ship approaches the edge, and the gang rescue it before befriending the distinctly Norse natives. After a parallel history lesson, Kin concludes that the disc must be a company artifact. Travelling with the Vikings, Marco fights off a dragon attack before landing and using the dumbwaiter as a portable Valhalla until a brawl ensues. Amid tales of the second coming of a Christ-like figure, the rest of the gang's ship crashes across the disc with its impact felt everywhere. After some healing and goodbye gifts, the gang don their flying suits and resolve to head inward to the hub and the home of the disc's masters.
Have you got some pent-up poetry energy? That was very beautifully done.
I haven't written any poetry for ages, so yeah, I think it snuck in.
That was very enjoyable. Well done, Joanna.
Thank you.
And the raven hides was one of the standout lines there.
I think, honestly, it was just having a raven lurking around gave me a lot of opportunities. Yeah. Something poetic about a raven.
Yeah, someone should write a poem about that.
Yeah, I wonder if anyone's done that. No, never more. Anyway. Oh, very good. I'm sorry.
You're a delight. Did you see any helicopters?
Lots of things fly. They do. Lots of things fly. So
lots of things do fly, Joanna. Do any of them fly in a helicopterish motion?
Yes. Okay. No further questions.
That was genuinely an ask. I forgot to look out for it. So
I didn't notice any direct helicopter parallels, but I'm still keeping the bit.
I've got to say, for once, I'm not sure loincloths are implied.
I don't know, the Norsemen.
I don't think Norsemen last very long in loincloths, darling.
Yeah, probably not. Might be wearing them under their leather watsits.
Okay, leather watsits, strongly implied.
Yes, many leather watsits.
But yes, generally no, then, is the answer to this bit.
Yeah, all right, no loincloths.
It's all right, it can sometimes just be no.
Quotes, I believe yours is first.
Yes. Kin is arguing with herself about whether to follow this interesting chap with an interesting job. She switched off and sat back. "You should have told the company," she said silently. "There's still time." She answered, "You know what will happen. He might be mad, but he's no fool. He'll be prepared for any trap. Besides, Kung isn't a human world. Company runs thin down there. He'll duck and weave and we'll lose him." She said, "You have a duty. You can't let a menace like him run around loose just to satisfy your curiosity." She answered, "Why not?" which I think is a wonderful motivation to start a book with.
Yes, I greatly enjoy that.
And why the devil not? I think yours is a little more profound, is it not?
Yeah, maybe. Kinney's on the ship and thinking as they're heading to the Flat Earth. She thought of how attitudes to aliens got stereotyped. Kung were paranoid, bloodthirsty and superstitious. Shandy were calm, bloodthirsty and sometimes ate people. Shandy and Kung thought humans were bloodthirsty, foolhardy and proud. Everyone thought Fs were funny and no one knew what Fs thought about anyone. Dot, dot, dot. We dismiss each other with a few clichés, she thought. It's the only way we can live with one another. We have to think of aliens as humans in a different skin, even though we've all been hammered by different gravities on the anvils of strange worlds. And it's a nice early thought here that I'm going to go into a lot more when we talk about the back half of the book, because the thought gets expanded into.
Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, I think that's going to be a fun.
Yes,
the nature short of discussion.
Aliens and humans.
Yes. Yeah, we touched on it in the last book, didn't we? But I think this book is a better realisation of what Proctor was clearly thinking about.
Yeah, the last book we mean Dark Side of the Sun, not
yes, not Meadow Times, yeah.
Sort of nature, yeah, actually, the nature of how species and things relate to each other.
Yeah, I'm just crackling on my mic. Probably just me flailing my head around too much. Okay.
Yeah, you're flailing. So yeah, onto characters.
Characters.
So we start with Kin.
Protagonist, yes, Kin. Kin, our who I'm antagonist. Trying not to say Kim.
Yeah, she's definitely Kin, not Kim. There's a very good quote from a friend of the pod / Oraclette, Mark Burrows, about Kin.
Oh, yeah.
The book's central protagonist, Kin Arad, is a woman in her prime, sardonic, controlled, and quite sexual. The blurb for the paperback edition even describes her as hot-blooded.
Terrible.
She is a universe away from the man.
Can we add that onto the...
Yeah, we absolutely can. She's a universe away from the man who created her. Perhaps she would get better at writing outgoing, confident women, but his skills weren't yet up to the job of reaching so far outside of his experience. Kin has not only come of age, she's been of age for a few hundred years. She's not flawed enough to be interesting and not developed enough to be relatable. Kim is basically too cool for someone as fundamentally oddball and nerdy as 30-year-old Pratchett to handle. Some misjudged cracks about sexual favours and a few fner sniggers don't help matters either.
Okay. First of all, the newer edition, I must say, has gotten rid of hot-blooded, I notice. So that's nice.
Yes, I don't have the energy to get up and get my other copy and see if it's still on there.
Yeah. I have a feeling you mainly agree with Mark on this one.
Mainly. I've got to say,
I think it's a little harsh. I definitely get what he's saying in that she isn't as like fleshed out, or not even fleshed out, not as believable a character as a lot of Pratchett's protagonists. But I don't know. I didn't. The bar might be on the floor here.
Yeah, the bar is low.
I just feel like, considering the genre, most men write, most men in this kind of space write women a lot worse. Like,
yeah, Mark does. Sorry, let me just find the page again. But Mark does go on to make the point. This sort of mishandling of strong women and sexuality was fairly common in the world of hard sci-fi that Pratchett had grown up with, and he can hardly be blamed for inheriting the problems of a wider genre.
Yeah, I'm not even, I don't know. I didn't.
I think she's a good character. I think having a female-led sci-fi at all is excellent.
Yeah.
Again, the bar is on the floor. This book passes the Bechdel test, which a lot of Discworld books don't.
Mm.
I think I would probably agree with Mark more if we were later in our read-through of the Discworld, but as it is, we're still early enough that we haven't had a lot of really strongly realised female characters outside of the witches. So Kin does feel... She needs more development, but so does every character. This is someone's third novel.
Yeah.
There's lots of room for improvement in general. So I agree with Mark and I don't, if that makes sense.
Yes.
But I do think she is weirdly sexualized.
That's interesting, because as I read it, I was thinking, this is weirdly unsexualized for the genre. So he mentions like her being naked a few times, as you've mentioned in the plan. But it's never like lingered upon, male gazey.
Oh, yeah. It's not like gross overall bad descriptions of breasts. She's not breasting boobily everywhere. There's just a kind of, as we've got a woman in this place, we're going to put her naked because of course she's using that. And, more so in the latter half of the book.
Yeah, yeah. That's
Silver makes lots of comments saying, well, you can just offer sex to get out of things. It's more she's unnecessarily naked. There's a line on, I think it's the page after my quote, so it's page 77, at least in my edition, where she's been lying in bed thinking about what she's going to do, and then she padded naked down the equatorial corridor.
Mm.
You could just take the word naked out of that sentence. There is absolutely no need for her to be naked. And as there's, she then goes and has a conversation with Marco. As there's no bit in the book that mentions her putting clothes on, she's just naked for the entire next scene. Okay. And, like, if nothing else, she must be chilly.
I guess. I mean, yeah, I don't know.
It's not a giant criticism. It's not this makes the book bad for me.
No, I don't know.
I just think it's a weird detail.
I kind of read it at the time as in, I may be too generous just as a, and this is how little she gives a fuck about stuff like being naked, because like the entire body at this point is constructed and changes all the time. And
well, yeah, I mean, also she's 200 years old. She can change her skin and hair colours, whatever she wants, which also, yeah. I think it, when you combine it with looking at the Josh Kirby illustration,
that's what I was going to say. I feel like if you came into it without looking at that cover, it's a lot easier to,
she's less weird,
be generous with it perhaps. Yeah,
she's not weirdly sexualized in the book. She has a sexual history, and that's actually, you know, that's good writing of a female character rather than
no Madonna whore shit going on.
No, not at all. And you know, she's also not tanned and blonde, which is a nice change for Pratchett. In fact, her skin is still dyed black, I think, for most of the book.
It goes from black to silver and then possibly back to black.
She calls herself an Ethiopian princess at one point. Yeah. So I'm assuming that,
yeah, I feel like it was a detail Pratchett put in and then didn't think much about as he edited, but yeah.
No, I know, but then to draw just,
yeah. Oh yeah, no well, I mean, like, I think there's some, like, when did you flick between skin colors again bits in,
yeah, but yeah. But yeah, but then to stick a bog standard sci-fi cliche, boobs in eight dimensions.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, like, that was, I just, that's feel Kirby, like the Kirby kind of in joke, wasn't it, with Pratchett and Kirby or whatever. I don't know. Yeah. It's just, it is a part of it I just don't quite grok, and that's probably fine.
Oh yeah.
I like, do not like the cover. And the other cover, the non-Kirby one, is much worse. So.
Yes, Mark Burrows tweeted us another one of the covers, and it is also ridiculous.
I'm not sure it's, like, less realistic in the boob department, but it is far more, this just looks like soft porn.
Yeah. At least with Kirby, it's very stylized.
Like, yeah, no, and you've got the aliens.
No one's getting off to that.
Was it tits and filigree? Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, none of these criticisms are like are me cancelling 30-year-old Terry Pratchett.
No, I know. It's all right. I'm not having a go. I read it slightly differently as well.
You know, I can't take even the slightest bit of criticism without collapsing. It's not even a criticism. I know. I can't take this.
I can't.
Let's see, who else have we got? We've got Jago J-Lo.
Jago J-Lo.
The Terminus Probe pilot who has returned with news of the Flat Earth.
Mm-hmm.
There's nice little details. Like, he's clearly kind of a dick. He threatens everyone with a pistol. He's weirdly speciesist in a way that I think is meant to highlight he's old-fashioned because he's not dealt with people for 1,000 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he's pissed off that he's accidentally ended up with two aliens. He wanted a human-only crew.
Yeah.
Although, say that, I read that as speciesist, but looking at what the disc is like, it may have just meant he didn't want to take non-humanoids there because the people on the disc couldn't cope with it.
Well, he was very rude about it.
But he was a dick about it. But yeah, he sort of feels weirdly underdeveloped. Like, his whole motivation seems to be having lots of money to live off, or days, or whatever.
Yeah, yes. And I thought it was interesting to take him out at that point.
Yeah, I like that he's taken out, because I like the story of three people who don't know where they're going or what they're expecting.
Yeah.
A lot more than I like the story of,
here's the leader of the band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a there's a nice heist movie vibe to all three of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can almost sort of hear them going, "Ah, oh, you son of a bitch, I'm in."
Not much more to say about him in this part, is that?
No, I think we'll get into him a bit more in the second half. We'll definitely discuss him again.
Okay.
We've got Bjorn Chang and the Settlers. Excellent band name. The people who come to settle the new planet.
Oh, yeah.
And I just sort of, I liked this idea and this moment, this one very grizzled sort of, yeah, no, I know how to get a planet going.
Yeah.
And making them go for a 10-mile walk.
Me.
We're going for a 10-mile walk so we can see who steps on poisonous spiders.
Mm. I liked him as the kind of little set up as quite an authority-ish figure, and then the kind of, he was the first source of this little drop of information that the company might be in trouble. I thought that was quite clever.
Yeah, and then going on to Joel, one of her many ex-husbands, with his Neanderthal face, who goes into more detail about the potential trouble of the company.
Yeah, interesting that the Watcher thing I thought was quite interesting, and it feels like that's from something that I couldn't place a reference.
Yeah,
just because it wasn't really expanded upon much more than, you know, some cryogenic freezing thing.
Just like when we went through Dark Side of the Sun, I don't know enough about 70s hard sci-fi to spot every reference.
I found myself a few times in the like, I've read a bit more than you, but nothing compared to Jack. So I found myself a few times saying, hey, what's this? And either he'd be like, has from this book, or I think he made that one up. Thank you.
But I like the idea that Tin is horrified by the frozen thing. Like, she can't think of anything worse than being frozen for that long.
Yeah, it is interesting. Yeah.
Having lived for over 200 years herself. And there's this sort of weird thing of, like, I'm sure you're going to want to talk about immortality quite a lot as we talk through these two books, because that's this idea, life is currency.
Yeah.
She only wants to keep living for so long on the basis that she is living.
She doesn't not want just to for the sake off, of it.
Yeah, she doesn't want to put off her living until the future.
I think this is partly why I'm a little less critical than I would be of her character, just because I really like her, like, internal conversations about the immortality or the longevity thing. And even as I say that, I realize it's just kind of Pratchett using that as a narration space rather than any part of her. Well, it is a part of her character. I would say that is her, like, inner conflict bit, but it's not really a flaw, is it? So
I like her inner conflict. I do like her inner conflict, and I like it. There's less of a, I'd argue with the Discworld books, there's a certain amount of omniscient third person narration that drops into various people's heads, whereas this book is all from Kin's point of view.
Yeah. Oh, except for that one bit where it flicks between the three, so we can do the clever bit of Kim throwing out the wallet.
Oh,
make
make
a note of that. Yeah.
I liked that. That was like a little cups and balls thing.
Yeah.
That I enjoyed that. But I like the line about when Kin's sort of horrified that Joel wants to do this thing, and she's like, well, but you've never been bored. You spent 2 years learning how to make a wooden cartwheel. You said you'd never learned to spear a seal or cast copper. You said you were going to write the definitive work on robot pornography, and you haven't yet. And this is exactly what you and I would be like if we both had, like, an endless number of years.
Yeah. Like, it's kind of what we're like now. It's just, you know, we know that we're time in terrible finite. Trouble in the long term. Yeah.
Yeah. Just want to learn how to do everything.
Is that so much?
But I also don't want to put too much effort into learning, and if I can't master it in 5 minutes, then I'm giving up.
Yeah, there are precious few things that I've managed to get past that first bit with.
It's getting past the hurdle of, I've learned just enough to realise I know nothing.
Yes, yeah, exactly, yeah.
If I can get past that hurdle, I will stick to something for at least a day.
Good.
And then we've got, obviously, Rip Van Levine and the whole Terminus project.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting thing of way back in the past when spacefaring was a lot smaller. These people went on these thousand-year voyages and were kept alive. And now the technology exists to bring them home or wake them up or find them. This guy has insisted that they are sent out to do everything other than be woken up.
Yeah, the last, what is it, one or two that are left?
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was a cool little bit, a bit dark. The guy who woke up or was dropped off somewhere where humans had already been for centuries. And like, yeah, he didn't need to expand on it, but you can imagine the kind of sense of, well, what the fuck was that for then?
Yeah. Why did I waste so much of my life in this?
Yeah. And like, I gave up literally my life.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a part of it where you'd be like, oh, well, you know, now I at least get to experience the future and not in a way where I have to like colonize Mars kind of thing. But yeah. On the other hand, it'd be like, well, fucking waste of time that was, wasn't it?
Yeah. I can understand the sort of weird joy and depression of what he went through and why he said, like, don't wake them up, let them sleep.
It's like the extreme version of the explorers getting to the North Pole second.
Yeah. So I think it's part of it is I was going to be the one to do this,
yeah,
and then bring back this glory to Earth. And that's kind of interesting because then that's kind of, J-Lo is the one who has made this big discovery and actually brought something glorious back in his very specific way.
Self-serving way, yeah.
Yeah, very self-serving.
So he's lived to like nearly 1,000, hasn't he? So I guess the...
You kind of start putting yourself first at some point.
Yeah, he probably just turned into a dick after a bit.
I'm a self-centered dickhead now and I'm only 28.
Marco Farfara.
Yes, we're on to our sort of core three gang, or the other two members of Marco Farfara, who is a naturalized human being that looks like a cunt.
Gonna sound like an insult when you say it like that.
I didn't mean it like that. I'm very happy for Marco, regardless of his species.
There's a lovely bit of nature versus nurture debate kind of sewn into his character, isn't there?
Yeah. He insists that he's human, but has to constantly fight his his natural kung instincts.
Yes.
And his whole sort of, I've got four arms and I keep accidentally starting massive fights.
Yeah. And then you've got Silver, the other... dangerous crew member.
Silver is a Shandy with massive tusks, although hers are unscrewable.
Yes.
Which
is a bit taboo, not done kind of thing.
Yeah, it's Fangless Shandy were usually children or condemned criminals.
Yeah.
But Shandy has chosen to have hers removed so that she can be a good linguist.
Yeah.
Which is an impressive state of... I have devoted, this is like a Shandy thing that they'll pick things and decide to be very obsessed with them.
Yeah.
I can't relate.
Anyway, yeah, dedication to the cause.
Absolute dedication to the cause. And the actual Shandy culture, which is, they basically like cannibalism.
Yeah. Or like have to do cannibalism, I guess, because they can't digest anything else.
And these dumbwaiter things are able to create pretty much the only food they can eat.
Yeah.
So now they have... the game, which is two Shandy basically fighting each other to the death so one can eat the other.
It's an interesting concept.
It is an interesting... They're very... For a short book, and I think I'll talk about world building later, and we said this with Dark Side of the Sun, well, he manages to establish an entire culture in not many lines.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure. And it's very cleverly done. And then... Not really a character, but the previous race, the Spindles, who built sort of the big terraform type things that they're now using to build planets.
Yeah.
Who they weren't gods, but they do until God showed up. And they were these sort of huge, massive thing, 3 meters tall, but weighed 90 pounds, all telepaths and claustrophobic. Couldn't have more than a few on a planet because the brain noise would get too much.
Yeah.
Again, it's very, very clever building this entire concept.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah. And then it's just kind of dropped casually and then they went extinct like 500,000 years ago or something, whatever it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like it was very recent right up until he says that.
Yeah. It's just very known or apparently known. And who do we have? Eriksson, who is leading the sort of Norse hordes on the flat Earth, which appears to be a historical parallel of real Earth, but is missing things like the New World.
Yes, unfortunately for them.
Yeah, I won't go into a massive history lesson. What is it? She says, in the year 322, Ericsson sailed the ocean blue. Obviously, our Ericsson in this book is meant to be a parallel of the round world one.
Mm-hmm.
Leif Ericsson was thought to be the first Norseman to reach North America. There's a settlement called the Vinland that is spoken of in the old sagas, and it's believed that was actually North America.
Mm-hmm.
Ericsson, it's a family name, and it's a patronymic, as in he was the son of Eric. Specifically,
here's Joanna not going into a history lesson.
I just really like the word patronymic. Ericsson is the son of Eric, and he was specifically the son of Eric the Red, who was the first who founded the first settlement on Greenland. So some of the history does work. Obviously, the book goes into this whole idea of how the world took place historically and how it's paralleling to this flat earth that is missing half of the land.
Yes, yeah.
But some of the actual evidence for how we know about things like Ericsson and Eric the Red and the actual historical Norse saga as opposed to the mythological Norse sagas, it's very interesting because it was more than just a tradition of oral storytelling. There were lots of ways in which these stories were shared and remembered. And if you are interested in more of that, I will once again direct you to You're Dead to Me. They've got a very good episode on the Norse sagas.
Oh, cool. I would like to listen to that.
Yeah, so it's awesome. The woman who they have on as a historian is clearly just like deeply, deeply passionate and cannot and so excited to talk about it. It's great.
Oh, I love that stuff. Cool.
Yeah.
All right, I'll listen to that later. Thank you. Yeah, I did a bit of digging for the obscure reference finial on some of this. So I did a brief bit of reading on some of the Norse explorations and would very much like to learn more about it now. So yes, excellent.
Love a bit of Norse history. And then, yeah, locations. We don't go to many places. We've obviously got
We've got the widths and breadths and depths of the universe at our grubby little fingertips, yeah.
Who are you calling grubby?
These guys.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's fine. So we've got Kung, Marco's home planet.
Yeah, very damp little bit of a patch. It's clearly kind of in a very damp world, like the last, what was it called? Dark Side of the Sun, home planet. Very damp.
Can't remember.
We went on about it for a while.
We did. Can't remember what it's called for the life of me.
Anyway, very damp.
Yeah. Kung has an overlarge moon and a cool, close sun, so nightmare tides. Vegetation was either fungal or it was resigned to a semi-submerged life.
Yeah. Line top is hovering above Kung, isn't it?
Yeah. And the idea is these are sort of like, almost like airports.
Yeah, and seemed quite more porky.
Yes. It's halfway between a city and an airport. They're like these big transportation hub type things that most planets have. And at line top, there is a pub. And the pub is called the Broken Drum.
Huzzah. Currently broken.
Currently broken, for those keeping track. But it's nice to see it pop up this early and have the joke explained to me because it never occurred to me why it's called the Broken Drum.
Because?
You can't beat it.
But, oh, wait, no.
You can't
do the rim shot. Way.
So I'm glad we finally learned that. I mean, it probably could have occurred to me, and I'm sure it has occurred to many of our listeners, and it's actually quite an old joke, but no thoughts, head empty. And then the disc.
Yes. The brief stop off on original Earth.
Oh, yes.
Or Earth, but not really enough detail there at the moment to go into.
Yeah, we do sort of hear more about Earth and the various Earths.
But this is Earth.
Yeah. Kin is from Earth.
You know, that one.
That one.
Anyway, sorry, the disc.
Yeah, I like, he's almost put a lot more thought into it here than with the Discworld, where it's just like, Discworld, the physics just kind of works and there's a lot of magic. But here, because
which
it's
sci-fi.
Which I
think is to its benefit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The disc has the one half page footnote explaining how the eight seasons worked, and then it's never gone into again, and that's fine. But in sci-fi, things have to work.
Yeah, or at least have a little dalliance with reality.
Vague logic somewhere. So there's like a big sort of glass spherical dome around it with fake planets in it.
Probably not glass, but yeah.
Well, okay, yeah. I don't know. Space glass.
Space glass.
I love the description. It was like a plate full of continents, a coin tossed into the air by an indecisive god.
Ah, yes. Patrick getting well into his good descriptive powers there.
Yeah. With a polar cap hugging one side as opposed to the disc where it's sort of warmer as you go towards the outskirts and the hub is a big tower of ice.
Yes. Which again, I think is he's tried to logic it in this one, hasn't he? Rather than.
Yeah, there's a sort of bunch of detail about how it could work and why there's a sun and the moon wobbling on its axis for the sake of tides and how it's clearly not working, which goes into this whole idea of matter transport, which they're obviously all very interested in.
As one would be.
Missing a new world, which I think the idea that the people who are curious enough to explore and try and find a new world end up sailing off the edge.
Yes.
There's something odd about that.
Yeah, there's some kind of inbuilt instinct in them to want to
see what else is out there.
And then go, oh no.
I'm glad there's a nice big fence around the room in the Discworld.
Well, yeah, even if it's mainly for kidnapping purposes.
Mild kidnappings.
And it's only a bit of the disc it's got there.
I'm sure there are other safety measures around other edges of the disc.
Oh, I'm sure, yes. Very up on health and safety, the average Discworld denizen.
Yep. Anyway, that's all I have to say.
What's a denizen etymology as opposed to citizen?
I don't know. Is it something to do with the word designated?
Maybe let's look into that, denizen. Cool. Yes. Is that all the
locations? I think that's all the ones I feel relevant to our discussion.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Should we go get a coffee?
Good idea. You can look up denizen.
A denizen comes from Latin originally and basically meant from within. Citizen was based on the Latin civitas, city, obviously, and was probably altered to closer match denizen due to the similarities in definition.
Ah.
That's that.
Fun etymology lesson for the day. I like it.
Oh,
right.
Stretch.
Same. Little bits that we liked.
Oh, did we like some little bits?
I like lots of little bits in this book.
You like lots of little bits all very close together.
It did. It's a very funny book.
Yeah.
I think it's got lots of nice little funny moments along with
it. Yeah, so it's not really got any laughy bits, though, has it, like Discworld?
It's not got full belly laugh moments, but it's got bits that made me smile, including the early prank Kin is chastising two young builders in her office for planting a pliosaur with a placard holding a placard that says end nuclear testing now.
Yes, I did like that.
That's exactly the sort of thing I would do if I was building a planet. And then slightly later on in a similar section, Kin is, among other things, wrote a book called Continuous Creation, because she'd done everything else, so she decided to write a book. And I just love the line, the actual writing hadn't been difficult. The real problem had been learning how to make paper.
And like, I'm going to write a book.
There's something about books and paper and printing have all fallen out of society now. But someone decides to write one, so has to invent paper and a printing press to do so.
It's good. It's got very, this task was meant to take 2 minutes vibes, but on a large scale. This task was meant to take 2 minutes, and now I've had to reinstall everything on my computer and invent paper. So
it reminds me quite a lot of Francine's transcribing our early episodes.
Yeah, that's going well.
So decided to invent a podcast-specific shorthand to assist with it.
Well, that's not shorthand so much as a very long AHK script. But but yes, that's the idea behind it. But then I got distracted and tried to learn actual shorthand.
Yeah.
But then I realised I picked a shorthand which was like 100 years old and only really used by clergy. And so then I gave up and now I need to just get back to doing the transcript.
Yeah. Big inventing paper to write a book energy.
I don't remember what I was intending to do with the shorthand. It wasn't the transcript.
I think you wanted to get one of the little stenography machines.
I did briefly look at that and I'm glad I didn't. That was very nearly an impulse purchase because now I've lost interest in that now. So that would have been a very quick regret.
This is like near the beginning of lockdown where I nearly bought myself a loom.
oh yeah, well done on not buying a loom. I'm pretty sure I was firmly against that. I'm often supportive in your hobbies, but I was pretty sure you didn't want a loom in your heart of hearts.
I still kind of want a loom.
I'm putting it in the same category as the bird. Don't get a bird. Don't get a loom.
Won't get a bird.
They scream. They need a lot of attention.
What, looms?
Yeah. Little known fact. That's why the Industrial Revolution was so good.
Got rid of the screaming looms. Speaking of Industrial Revolution, robots, Morris dancing.
Nice. Yeah, that was a nice little preview of Pratchett's interesting obsession with Morris dancing.
An obsession with Morris dancing and its purpose of protecting the earth and bringing in the seasons and generally having
purpose.
Yeah. I like to pretend it does have that much purpose for when I have to explain Morris dancing to my non-British friends. But this is when we go back to the original Earth, and Kin is remembering as a child that these Morris dancing must take place. And so the robots dance the caretaker Morris because there aren't enough people to spare to do things like learning how to dance. So they've taught the robots to do it. It has to be danced.
Nice little trope inversion of usually when robots become intelligent enough to be useful, they hinder the human race somehow, whereas this one, they are literally just being helpful.
They are. And this is where Kin decides that people should not go extinct. And it's the robots that have helped people to not go extinct.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I'm not entirely sure why Morris dancing would lead one to believe that humans shouldn't become extinct, but each to their own.
Personally, Morris dancing is my main reason for wanting the destruction of the entire human race. In my super villain monologue. No offence to any actual Morris dancers listening. We deeply respect you.
I like Morris dancing partly because of Pratchett and partly because my ex-boyfriend really hated Morris dancers for some reason.
Oh yeah.
So for the same reason I've got a bit of a grudge against Star Wars, I like Morris dancers by default.
It's amazing how many opinions we form based on being contrary.
Yeah, I've got to stop taking the piss out of you for being contrary, actually.
So metaphors.
Yes, metaphors. Your pointing out of Pratchett's description of the disc was one I didn't note actually. But I think Pratchett is starting to, he did in the last book actually, flex his metaphorical metaphor muscles.
Try saying that five times fast. Metaphorical metaphor muscles.
There was an old Kung story, said Marco softly, his voice like the currents in quicksand.
Ooh.
Anyway, that was the one I pointed out, but just wanted to point out that throughout there are some very nice
metaphors and similes.
Yeah, very nice turns of phrase. That's what I was trying to say. But how about talking points? Let's go on to bigger things.
Shall we start on parody versus doing the thing?
Dash, non-problematic edition.
Yes.
We've talked in the past about the difference between satire or parody and just doing the thing. And in the past, it's come up in kind of problematic contexts, are we just being sexist or similar?
It usually comes up in the context of women breasting boobily.
Yeah, as they do, of course. And so many sci-fi writers beautifully depict. But in this case, I think I touched on it in The Dark Side of the Sun as well, is I find it hard to distinguish myself enjoying this book and enjoying another short sci-fi book. In that I think it's a good sci-fi story, and although it's perhaps a little more tongue-in-cheek than most of them, I'm not sure when something stops and obviously it's got so many heavy-handed references to Ringworld that it is indisputably a parody, but I'm not sure when you start enjoying it just for itself or whether it matters, or, you know, there's this whole grey area in the genre.
I think especially in this first half, because we're setting up so much, I think a bit of the denouement definitely falls more into parody as he starts playing with especially some fantasy tropes. But in this section, it's a good sci-fi story. I think Dark Side of the Sun was a bit more on the parody side.
Yes.
It almost tried to be, you know, reference, joke, reference.
Yeah, it's a bit more like Colour of Magic in that respect. Yeah. I see what you did there.
Yeah, I'd say, like, if Dark Side of the Sun is to Colour of Magic as this is to maybe one of the Witcher's books, where it settled into the genre, put it on comfortably, and now can just exist nicely in it.
Shuffle around in it.
Yeah.
Very good, yes. Yeah.
It's clearly a love letter to the genre.
It is, yeah. And there's so many little nods in there that leave you without doubt that he's read just an insane amount of sci-fi for any, as I said, 30-year-old man to have read. But considering how much fantasy he's also clearly read.
Yeah.
And folklore and history.
There's so much in it.
I've got 2 months till I turn 13. So I've got to catch up.
Something I didn't look up, but I'm assuming there is a folkloric equivalent of the barometer story that Marco tells. I think you mentioned the metaphor that as he goes into that story. A king had a tower and he said
yes.
People could have untold riches if they could tell him exactly how tall the tower was. And someone eventually, you know, people are doing all these complicated maths to check, and someone eventually gives a barometer to the master builder and says, how tall was the tower?
I think it's probably that one about the king who has fields, and he says, if you can, do you remember? Oh, fuck. If you do this for me, then you can get as much land as you can outline with this or whatever. And he did some fractal bullshit.
Yeah. There's lots of stories of that nature.
Yeah. I wonder if it's a specific one, actually. Now I say that, that's not as parallels I thought it was going to be when I started trying to remember and talk at the same time. Always a good idea.
Thinking and speaking at the same time is something we both do incredibly well.
So good at it. What a great idea to do a scripted, an unscripted podcast together.
back to your point.
Anyway, it's just in such stark contrast to something like Lord of the Rings, for instance, which again we've bitched about before. I really enjoyed it as like a, you know, it's a good segue actually into your talking point, which is world building. I think it's I think that's probably what makes it so enjoyable is the very.
It's a very good world building.
Yeah, very good. It's very good.
Isn't it good?
It's thorough, considering it's so concise, I'd say, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a short book. You know, the original smaller version of the paperback I've got is literally about 200 pages. It's not a big, epic, sprawling space opera, except it kind of is, just told very neatly. But it establishes so much of the universe. It establishes so much of how humans are, how they exist, what they want, what motivates people, then it establishes these other races very comfortably and very clearly. You have the Kung, you have the Shandi, you have, okay, the Ents are a bit of a side joke and they did make me giggle, flapping about these little tentacles.
I liked his voice box.
Sorry. For those listeners, you can see the video. I did an excellent tentacle dance there.
It was beautiful.
I worked hard on that. But also the literal world building.
Oh yes, like, literal world building.
they are literally building worlds. And right in that early section where Kin is berating the pranksters, one of them tries to quote her own words back at her. And this idea of what a planet is. A planet's not a world. A planet is a ball of rock. A world is a four-dimensional wonder. Let there be bottomless lakes peopled with antique monsters. Green ruins in endless jungles, bells beneath the sea, echo valleys and cities of gold. This is the yeast in the planetary crust without which the imagination of men will not rise.
Oh, I'm glad you managed to get that in there.
Yeah, that was nearly my quote. And then I decided I actually have more to say about it than just having it as my quote.
Yeah, it's always good to hear you read aloud the beautiful bits.
Thank you.
And good voice. Well done, Joanna.
And
that's why we did a podcast.
The theory, Kin's theory in her book, this idea that there were the spindles who built these worlds and put these fossils into the crust. And then eventually the spindles realized they weren't the originators and there were creators before them, the wheelers, and then before the wheelers, there were something else that I didn't write down, so I can't remember the name of.
Yeah. the almost inconceivable concept of some kind of half mile long sphere, wasn't it?
Yeah. But the idea that the universe has always been a made thing, there was never any chaos, there was never any randomness. It was always a generation of gods leaving something for the next generation of gods, and humans are the end result of this.
Yes, it is. This was the theory that races arose and changed the universe to suit themselves and died. And then other races arose in the ruins, changed the universe to suit themselves and died, and so on.
Hmm. And I love that. And I love that what the humans are doing to change the universe to suit themselves is to plant imagination.
Yeah. It's kind of seeding the kind of ground that they grew from.
Yes. I think it's really fascinating.
And making
think,
the ground.
Yeah. And then if you look at the world that Pratchett has built in a few pages, that contains all of this human condition, all of the human longing for immortality and becoming of gods, all of the theories about creation and taking away the random of the universe and making it something that bigger gods made before leaving to sub-gods and demigods.
Yeah.
There's something really, really marvelous in that, in a 250-page book.
Yeah.
That you can establish all of that and also a race called the Kung, who have four arms and can't not get into a fight.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, it is, as the kids say, a real page turner. I'm really glad I've got my glasses on for this video. I'm going to peer over the top of them. And I've got my hair drying and these curl things. So just generally extremely old right now.
I feel ancient just being near you.
Oh, thank you, Dad.
And yeah, as it's a very well-built sci-fi world, there's a lot of incredible sci-fi tech.
Yeah. I'm going to regret putting this down as a thing, because you know how good I am at just explaining science. but first of all, I would like a little shout out to the proto Roomba.
Yes.
And I think Pratchett's estate should sue Roomba for clearly stealing the idea here of the tiny little hover that comes out of the wall and gleams up as a little side note before somebody teleports in.
Yeah. I really want a Roomba.
Yes. Which, speaking of the world building, actually, the forerunners with the ancient tech is quite of a sci-fi trope.
Yeah.
And a fantasy trope, actually. If you think of like Robin Hobb's Dragons as my favourite. The what do you call them, dragonkin?
The elderlings.
Elderlings, thank you.
Yeah.
Getting my fantasy worlds confused, but yes, the ancient tech from another civilization left to be discovered, exploited, and probably misused by the new civilization, which is usually humans.
Yeah.
I thought that was done particularly well here, even though it was so vague, and almost probably because it was so vague. Because if there's one thing that puts me off getting more into hard sci-fi or reading more hard sci-fi, is when you kind of turn the page and see three pages of what you now know to be incorrect and outdated physics.
Yeah.
Now I've got to read this to understand what you think is. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is the other thing I like about Pratchett writing sci-fi, is that he kind of says, this is a bit of tech and it does this anyway.
Yes.
On with the story.
But even so, he manages to reference things like the Alderson disk, which again is a ring world thing, and that's when you squish together all of the planets in a solar system and make a big old planet with the sun in the middle.
Yeah.
Which is very much in the speculative science side of things, because we don't have any kind of material that could make that happen yet. Molecule strand travel, I thought was a rather neat idea. I was kind of imagining like a subway map almost.
Oh, yeah.
Of different stations, and then having to wander off London freestyle when you have to go to these other places.
Yeah.
And finally, I thought the invisibility cloak was particularly interesting, because he's referencing what we now call metamaterial cloaking, which is the distortion of the light spectrum to cause the invisibility effect, basically,
yeah.
Which is what he described in slightly different terms. But that didn't come to be called that until early this century. And what I didn't manage to find out in my brief digging was how far into the research we'd gotten by the 80s when this was written. Or whether this was just a reference to Star Trek's kind of cloaking device, which was the same thing, wasn't it? It was bending light around.
I think the idea has existed in sci-fi a lot longer than the scientific research has progressed. That was a bad sentence. That's not what I meant.
No, I know what you mean. Yeah.
I'm not saying sci-fi gave scientists the idea. I'm saying the idea existed a lot of times.
They didn't seed it.
True. A lot of times ideas exist in sci-fi because someone who doesn't have the scientific knowledge to start the research goes, well, but I bet science could probably eventually.
Yeah, and absolutely. Then
science probably eventually.
Yes, sci-fi authors often predict or comment on things which then become a lot
coming
more
into reality.
But I thought it was quite interesting because the protagonist, Kin, is very shocked by this technology in this very high-tech society. And so it's clearly moved along in the real world much faster than was predicted in the 80s.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. And possibly so have some of these other concepts that I know less about, but probably not molecule strand travel. Don't know whether, what that was rooted in.
But we can hope.
Oh, we can hope. Oh, I don't know. Actually, there's so much to do here. I really do need this immortality alongside the space travel if I'm going to do that. With all the confidence of someone who's surely going to be picked to be an astronaut, despite the lack of physical fitness and scientific knowledge.
Yeah, we'd make perfect astronauts if you ignore all of the factors that would make us terrible astronauts.
Yeah. I think that's pretty much all I have to say on the tech for now. Probably because I want to talk about all the longevity stuff next week. So all the gene therapy and all that kind of side of it is going to be.
Yes, we are going to delve into immortality, which is someone like us. We never talk about wanting to be immortal.
I'm never going to die.
But along with these seeds of early sci-fi and obviously things that have come into technology and not, we have the seeds of future Pratchetty ideas. And I enjoy looking for these in the early ones. I had fun with them with Dark Side of the Sun as well. And Dark Side of the Sun had the similar thing of ancient tech from previous.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
Although slightly more fantasy oriented there, wasn't it? Almost.
It was almost actual gods, and there was a lot more mystery. There was a lot more mystery to it in Dark Side of the Sun. And a big part of the plot was chasing the mystery, whereas...
Yeah, this one, it was kind of... He drew out the kind of information release in quite a satisfying way, but it wasn't the point of the...
Yeah. Yeah. It's another thing that world building does really well, actually, is not info dumping.
Yes, yes. It's unlike... Yeah. Dark Side of the Sun did a bit of an info dump right at the beginning, didn't it? I remember pitching about that.
It's given to you as it becomes relevant to the story.
Yes.
And not in an annoying, drawn-out mystery way.
Yeah.
But sort of proto-Pratchetty stuff. This is our proto-Pratchett season.
Proto-Pratchett.
Obviously, big flat disc world is kind of... I wonder what that could have led to.
A disc world, you say?
Mm. Yeah, it's a disc.
A world that is a disc.
Got a rim, it's got a hub. I actually I read a few reviews as well, and there are a few reviews written after Colour of Magic and Light Fantastic come out, and sort of a lot of them talked about this as this is in a way the first Discworld novel.
It really
sets the stage for the concept.
Even though it is so very different.
There is even a specific line from Silver: some humans used to believe the world was flat and rested on the back of four elephants, says Silver. And Kin asks, what did the elephant stand on? And Silver explains, a giant turtle swimming endlessly through space. Kin tasted the idea. Stupid.
I like tasted the idea, actually.
I love tasted the idea.
Mm.
But I like Pratchett writing off what will become over 40 of his books as a stupid idea.
But it is, and he acknowledges it. Through Mincewind often.
Yeah. Well, it's nice because he's tied to the sci-fi setting here, like I was saying earlier. He's also tied to making sure the disc works, whereas in the fantasy setting of Discworld proper, it doesn't really need to work. It's just, there's a turtle, there's some elephants, and now let's crack on with the nonsense.
Yes.
but some of the other seeds planted I really annoyed. Actually, going back to Bjorn and the Settlers, which my entry for Eurovision next year.
Yeah, it's definitely like a Scandinavian 60s band, isn't it? Yeah,
very much
so. Possibly 70s,
Or something in the spirit of the Viking dance from the Georgia Nicholson books.
Yes. Anyway, sorry.
Sorry, deep cuts there. Deep cuts. I got this idea of a new group of people showing up to colonize a new planet and people it, and their immortality being living on and having children as opposed to gene therapy and things.
Yeah, yeah.
And one person going with them who knows what he's doing. It all really, really reminded me of, I think, the seeds planted there for the Long Earth series, which...
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. There's a lot of... I think that this very... There's this pioneer part of Pratchett that is lives deep in there and is just like, oh, I really want to just find a new fucking planet. Yeah. Can we start again?
And this idea of lots of new Earths and then them being... pioneered and learning what works best and criticizing the idiots who built a church first and then all starved in winter.
Oh, I really can't wait to get onto Long Earth now.
Yeah, I really want to reread them.
Don't waste my time away here.
None of this is major spoilers if we've got listeners who haven't read Long Earth, by the way.
It's on the blurb.
But they're fun books and we are going to talk about them because they are, I love them. And then the other idea, it's a throwaway line in Good Omens, but this whole thing of fossils being planted.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And in Good Omens, it's a joke, like, the Earth actually is only this old and the fossils are a joke the paleontologists haven't got yet. But here it's really beautiful. This idea of the spindles planting fossils of things that never existed. And part of it was they needed this fossil strata beneath them because of their nature and telepathic, and they needed stuff under the ground.
Grounding, yeah.
They needed grounding. But she talks about it, you know, it was their art. They didn't know if anyone would see it, but they went ahead and did it.
Hmm.
And I think that's a really lovely thought.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, Kin's kind of thoughts on world building, literal world building, and how all these details are necessary to make humankind.
Yeah, the yeast of imagination thing we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, yeah. Is kind of hinted at again here, isn't it, in some of this alternate history or bit where they're saying, what if Venus didn't have its visible moon orbiting? And what if the Vikings hadn't managed to conquer the rest of Europe, kind of thing.
What would they have done instead?
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, we're living it, yay.
That's the speculative part of the speculative fiction, except it's speculating in the opposite direction.
Yeah, yeah.
Unspeculate, no, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when thing happens?
We'll workshop that, yes. Well
anyway, I think that's all I can ramble on about vaguely. Do you have an obscure reference video for me?
Yeah, I thought I'd go very Earth-based, as we were so spacey.
Ooh.
Kin, when she's kind of working out that this is an Earth parallel place, says something along the lines of, if these Vikings are trying to find the new world, we should be around, like, climatic optimum. Whereas in actual fact, the sea seems to be doing its own thing. But so I was like, oh, I never heard of that. So I looked it up. The kind of the base thing you get when you look for climatic, not climactic. I've trained myself to say climactic. So I'm now trying to say this. Yes. Was a few thousand years ago. So I think we can assume we mean the little climatic optimum, which was 900 AD to 1300 AD, which was indeed concurrent with the kind of prosperity in Europe, which possibly led to Norse people settling Iceland and Greenland, Eric the Red, and exploring the New World, Leif Erikson. It is a little controversial as to whether this little brief period of warming actually happened and whether, if it did, if it was just the Northern Hemisphere or whether it was a worldwide thing. But there definitely were a lot of like good periods of harvest around this time, a lot of crop diversification, and it did coincide with this Norse attempt at expansion. And then at the end, it went downhill pretty fast. So 1300 onwards was a bit shit, bad summers, famines, all that. And then the little ice age set in around 1400.
So yeah, right.
Just kind of put an end to inhabitable Greenland for a few centuries.
Mm.
and I'm not sure what did for the Viking settlement in Finland.
Cold.
I don't know.
Well, it was quite north.
It wasn't going to be any colder than home, was it? I don't know. There are probably actual reasons for this that have been written down somewhere, but I know that the remains are there to be looked at.
Mm.
So, yeah.
I didn't even notice the phrase climatic optimum within this.
Climatic optimum. And yes, I noticed it because I was like, oh, that's a nice little neat thing. I wonder what that is.
Marvellous.
Took me back to Vikings.
Excellent.
Everything leads back to Vikings.
Always leads back to Vikings. I think that's...
We haven't even talked about the crow, dude. Raven.
Raven. I mentioned him.
Yeah, I know, but let's mention him a little bit more as a nice little mystery.
Yes, I do enjoy the Raven as a little background mystery. Clearly very intelligent.
Mocking us slightly with his lack of motive so far, but we shall see.
I might get my cuddly toy Raven out to do the next book with us.
Quoth the Raven.
Oh, you should never do that anymore.
No. So.
Right. I think that's everything.
Yeah. Sorry. I think I'm out of interruptions, so feel free to see us out.
I am out of absolute bollocks to talk. We'll be back next week with part two of Strata, which starts on page 139 in my edition with They Circled the Thing in the Water Carefully. Was it alive, Kin wondered, or was it just that the waves made it appear so?
Mm.
Ooh. And we'll be going through to the end because we're only doing two episodes for this book.
Yes, and then a third episode on...
Bonus nonsense,
yes, for the 25th.
Yes. Possibly talking about some essays from The Slip of the Keyboard.
Yes.
Anyway, in the meantime, thank you very much for listening to The Two Shall Make Ye Fret. You can follow us on Instagram at The Two Shall Make Ye Fret, on Twitter at Make Ye Fret Pod, on Facebook at The Two Shall Make Ye Fret. You can join our subreddit, r/TTSMYF. You can email us your thoughts, queries, castles, ravens, and snacks at The Two Shall Make Ye Fret Pod @gmail.com. And if you want to support us, you can go to patreon.com/ The Two Shall Make Ye Fret and exchange some hard earned pennies for extra bonus nonsense.
Or even soft earned pennies. We're not fussy about the pennies.
I don't care how you got the pennies, just give them to us. And in the meantime, dear listener,
don't let us detain you. I can't just agree with you on everything, otherwise we won't have a podcast.
I know, but now I've got to go and faint dramatically for 10 minutes.
All right.